Well, here we are in the southwest corner of the Arts Quad at Cornell's first building.
Marl Hall.
Built in 1868. Well, it's a rough and ready building, isn't it? Quarried and built from stone just on Leib Slope, or just down the hill from here. And in an architectural style that was borrowed from a variety of buildings that A.D. White and Ezra must have seen at Yale and at Harvard. Rustic is probably a way of characterizing it. Heavy corners. The whole body of the building is heavily rusticated stone. Certainly a building appropriate to the pragmatism that Ezra Cornell brought to the early years of the university.
Soon after the university was established, a local farmer volunteered to provide elm trees to the campus, and there was a double row of elms that came down along the avenue here that established into a fantastic alley eventually, and then they eventually succumbed to Dutch elm disease.
And so as the vegetation is, you know, developed and then redeveloped, many of the important landscape features that were defined by vegetation have lapsed. So, you know, the Ezra Cornell walk that led from our bench to Ezra's, A.D. White's house has been lost now that trees have grown up more or less in the space that was the alley. One would hope that at some time in the future that might change.
It's also important to remember that this was the first of a triptych of buildings that really established the foundation for the Arts Quad. And it took a while for that all to develop, probably 150 years, but without these three buildings, it could have taken quite a different form.
Many works of architecture, they're often built, you know, during a certain stylistic period and only become valued and loved as part of the architectural legacy of a campus 100 years hence, and I think that's probably true for these buildings. They are relatively simple and undistinguished works if you view them, you know, in their time. But of course now they're sort of the essential legacy and foundation, architectural foundation of the university. And so we really love them in ways that transcend their style.
And this is very, very apparent in our interviews with students as well. They treasure these buildings, not, and in some ways mistake their tradition for excellence in architecture. They are not excellent architectural examples, but they are very important to the community of Cornell.
So as we go on from Morrill on to McGraw and White, we'll start to look at these three buildings comparatively. While they were built more or less in the same period, they are nevertheless buildings that benefited from sort of sequential sophistication, if you will, as the skilled trades became more capable of producing refined buildings, I guess you could say, for the campus. So as we go on to Mahler and White, we'll start looking at some of those detailed distinctions. Well, here we are at White Hall. As you can see from the archway, it was completed in 1868 and is Cornell's third building. Actually, second of the three stone quad buildings. McGraw comes later. And John, were you telling me a story about this altercation between Ezra and A.D. White?
Yes, in fact, it's typical of a lot of discussions that take place when architecture comes into play. And that is that when Whitehall was designed, Ezra saw an opportunity to save some money here. And rather than make it a twin of Marl Hall, there was discussion about actually lowering the cornice lines and the heights, floor-to-floor heights, so that we could save a few bucks. Andrew Dixon White appealed to Ezra with the help of Frederick Law Olmsted, saying that we need to be thinking about the long haul here and that these buildings need to be working together. And he, in fact, did prevail. And So the building was built as originally designed.
And from what we can gather from critical writings of the time, it was well received as a work of architecture along the lines of something you might see in Florence. And with that, why don't we go inside?
Thanks.
Well, here we are on the fourth floor of Whitehall. It's really exciting for me to be here, to be honest with you, because as a student of architecture at Cornell, I spent 5 years in Sibley, but in the late 50s, and until the late 50s, this was actually the studio space for architecture. And in the process of renovating the building as they are currently, you can hear in the background all the noise, they uncover all kinds of interesting mementos from years gone by when architecture lived here, and this became, I guess you could say, arguably the playpen for a number of young architects, probably among them Richard Meyer and others. But it's exciting for a variety of reasons. I mean, not least because we can see the construction, we can discover how these were built.
And yet, looking around, you can also see attention to detailing of the structural timbers and so forth that really give it a special character.
It's basically a masonry bearing wall building. All this stone was quarried from just down the hill, as we understand it. And as you look around, you can see how the sills are laid up on the masonry walls. And these large rooms up here were the central instructional spaces. And as we investigate the early years of this building, as we understand it, the ends of the buildings were the dormitories where the students were given their bucket of coal and water each day so they could stay warm and healthy.
And live a student life. Yeah, and this is this building, of course, is the twin of Marl Hall, which is two buildings down. So consider getting inside this building the same as getting inside Marl. Although we're told that this has a more refined masonry construction to it insofar as Goldwin Smith, when he was connected with the university, brought some masons from England to participate in the construction of this building, unlike Marl Hall.
And some of the things we've learned today as we've walked around are, for example, where Marl Hall was entirely gutted and the interior structure was replaced with a steel structure, here in 2001, the preservation architects involved have kept the party walls, the shear walls that are behind me and John here, intact so as to somehow preserve one of the essential structural elements of the original building, which I think is all to the good. So, John, this is the end. This is the one of the dormitory ends of the building, right? You can see how it's a lower ceiling. So, while that central space is a high vaulted classroom space with skylights, these were divided up into smaller rooms for students to live in. Do you remember the?
Yeah, what? It was double rooms, two students to a room with a common space shared, and I guess a fireplace nearby, but there was no running water, no electricity. That was pretty basic shelter.
But you can imagine that during the 40s and the 50s, the students who are up here as architecture students considered this to be their own personal playpen from all the graffiti and so forth that's around here. So, all the murals and such that have been painted on down through
some
those
over
years.
Overhead here. Planting owes Mr. Montflon $5.
They told us the story about that last time.
1945. And then over painted on it is paid in full.
But see, there are some of the barn beams that have come out. These sills that were in an old barn. And I just think it's incredible to think that you're producing, you know, one of the very first and very important buildings of the university, and you still want to make sure you don't spend too much if you can help it. I mean, that's part of the Cornell way, right?
Yeah.
Don't quote me on that.
Getting a start. This is 1866. This is probably Marl Hall, but this is about the same. So you can see the distribution of two doubles with a with a shared space and looks like a fireplace there.
Yeah.
And then a big common space.
Yeah, so this became a kind of a living room, a suite. It was a suite, basically.
Exactly.
Suite
arrangement.
Yeah. There you go. So they must. I wonder if they pulled up. Hey, how are you? So, do you have any stories to tell? We're our first guest.
No, I don't have anything
to say. Gary Wilhelm. Gary
Wilhelm. Nothing to say.
Graduated from Yale. He's not a Cornellian. He did not live up here.
But an architect, that's right. Nevertheless.
That's right.
A kindred spirit.
So, you haven't heard any good stories we can put on this tape?
No.
Remember that university buildings have a very long life, and they wind up being adapted to a variety of uses down through the centuries. And interestingly enough, John uncovered a passage in Casey's book regarding this matter, and Eddie White and Ezra were cognizant of that fact when they built these and didn't want to be viewed 100 years hence as fools for the construction they created during their lives. Good advice for those of us who build today. Well, John, that's pretty funny, you know. I mean, Gary Wilhelm tells us that there were no plans for Whitehall. It was actually a copy of Morrill.
Yeah.
But he hired his brother to be a contractor.
Yeah, good way to save a buck.
Yeah.
Yeah.
No architect, no contractor.
What economy. And Gary also says that there was a fair amount of student help in the construction. They knew how to do things in those days.
Yep, we still do, as a matter of fact. Thank you.
You're welcome.
Thanks, Mike.
Yep, thank you.
So now we'll go over and take a look at McGraw Hall.
So we have these two buildings, White and Marl, are both under construction, just about finished, and then McGraw comes on the scene. It's worth noting that both Sibley Hall and McGraw Hall were being built at exactly the same time, and things were pretty tight here on campus at that point, and they were drawing their materials from the same quarry, which, as we've said before, happened to be at the bottom of Live Slope and was having trouble keeping up. So, in fact, McGraw Hall was put on hold for a while so that Sibley could get finished.
It houses, among other things, a museum, science collection, library, and lecture halls at the outset, and also, after several years out in the rain, it became a place for Jenny McGraw's chimes to finally come indoors and reside. It was also intended that this site was going to be reserved for a chapel. Of course, that didn't happen. So instead we have Sage and later, of course, Annabelle Taylor as chapels for the university. You know, John, why don't you tell us about Frederick Law Olmsted's plans for a terrace, a great terrace to yoke these three buildings together with?
Actually, I think we've talked a little bit about Olmsted's connection with university. He met Andrew Dixon White and became interested in the campus. Ironically, his first piece of advice was don't build a quad, build a more informal setup. But once he was told that, thanks, but you're too late, he came back and delivered on helping the quad become established as a piece of land, as a major feature of the landscape at Cornell. And the feature that he advised that would bring it all together is a terrace that overlooked Live Slope and the valley below. And that idea reemerges periodically through the life of the university. It has never found realization, but it was definitely something that was high on Olmsted's list. Well, this is one of my favorite pieces. It isn't exactly architecture, but like anything old on campus, it's full of stories, and the story I like most about it is all in its timing. That here's this piece of hand-carved Carrara marble that appears on this rusticated farm site in 1873. It was put here as a drinking fountain by the class of 1873, 5 years after the first building was dedicated, at a time when there was no running water on the campus. Water came here by way of a horse-drawn wagon. But here you have this gesture of sort of confidence in the future, and a marvelous piece, and again, one of those commemorative pieces that Andrew White loved so much and wanted to see more of on the Cornell campus.